Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started with the Senate Judiciary Committee. I'm going to go ahead and call it to order for today, which is Wednesday, April 6th. We have one bill that's up for public hearing, a possible work session. We have a number of people that have signed up. I am on page 2 of witness registration. We also have in the committee a number of bills that need to be set for work session. That should be a reminder for all those who have those little things called cell phones. Please turn them off. We haven't yet implemented a pay-as-you-go, but we could start funding education with those if they continue to go off. I'll take the former Senator Walker's approach if we need to. So, and let's see, the chair's going to check to make sure his is off, just to make certain it is off. Okay. All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to start the public hearing. Here's the thing. I've got about 16 or 17 people currently that want to give testimony. I want to be able to hear from everybody who wants to give testimony, so we're going to have to limit the amount of testimony. The way that you can also help us is that if you're handing in written testimony, please do not read it into the record. It is part of the record. We will read it. What we would want you to do instead is to summarize whatever your points are. And if you hear other people making those same points, you can say, as other people have said, these are my points. And then we can get everyone on the record today and not have to cut it off. So we'll go with 3 minutes. Regarding the work sessions, we will be doing those once I get all of my members here. And depending on how the public hearing is going, we may have to break from the public hearing to take care of the work sessions, but we'll come back. With that, I'm going to go ahead and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 334. And Council.
Senator, Senate Bill 334 comes to you from Senator Hass and Representative Reed. It basically allows a judge to order joint custody even if both parties do not agree. If the court finds that the joint custody is in the best interest of the trial, provisions in this bill constitute a change in circumstance that allow a court to modify a current custody order.
All right. What I'm going to do is have Senator Hass, why don't you come up, and do you have anyone that you wanted to bring with you? And as I did not see, but is there any other members that are here that may have other obligations in the building? All right, Mark, if you can get us started, that would be great.
Thank you, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. Mark Hass, Senate District 14. I'm here with Andy Smith, who's a lawyer in my office and who's been researching this and has become quite expert in it. I won't read you my testimony, but this did start with a constituent and who has a story that I'm confident if he sat down with you like he did with me over a cup of coffee for an hour and relayed the last 11 years of his life, that you would look favorably upon making this change to the law. But in short, he was in what he described as a happy marriage 11 years ago when his wife fell for another guy. And sometimes that happens. And there was a divorce. And because the two exes could not agree on child custody, the court was forced by law to pick a winner based on the best interest of the child. In this case, it went to the mother. And neither his ex-wife or her new husband have held a job since then. He has been forced into a situation where he's paying a great deal of child support, not being involved in the child's life except for 2 to 4 days a month since then. And this whole issue speaks to a great unfairness. Since I've heard about his story and heard his story, I found that this is pretty common in Oregon, and that other states have looked upon this too and made the change and remedies a defect in the law that forces the court to marginalize one parent's rights in favor of the other. So we do have some stories coming after this that will, I think, put a human face on this issue, and I thank you for your consideration, and I will turn this over to the committee for a second.
Thank you. Chair Prozanski, committee members, for the record, my name is Andy Smith, legislative aide for Senator Hass, and I'm here today representing our constituent, Joe Kemp. Mr. Kemp has a compelling story, and there's certainly countless others who are and will suffer as he has. I feel I'd do a disservice to Mr. Kemp and to his story by telling it to you today, and you have his written testimony. But I would like to present one question for the committee to consider going forward. A question that may be overlooked, but one that I believe will add to the discussion. The question is, who is in a better position to determine the best interest of the child? Is it the legislature, or is it the courts? Under current law, the legislature has determined it is in the best position to decide what is in the best interest of the child when the parents do not agree on joint custody. In fact, the legislature decided that in every one of these situations, it is never in the best interest of the child for a joint custody order to exist. At the same time, in virtually every other question involving parenting time or custody, the legislature has determined the courts are in the best position to decide the best interest of the child. Senate Bill 334 is the legislature saying the courts should decide what is in the best interest of the child when the parents do not agree on joint custody, because the courts are better positioned to evaluate the merits of each situation, make findings of fact, conclusions of law, and issue orders memorializing those findings for each individual situation. Thank you for the opportunity to represent Mr. Kemp before you today, and on his behalf, I urge your support for this important piece of legislation.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel?
No, Mr. Chair, just a comment. Having been through the situation, I think allowing the court to have some flexibility in the best interest of the child rather than just a blanket ORS makes perfect sense to me. So thank you for bringing this.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. All right, what we're going to do is I've looked through the list of witnesses. I'm going to bring first a panel of those and the proponents, and then I will alternate with a group of opponents, and we'll go through that switching back and forth until we get through each of the different panels. So the first panel, and I apologize, the first name I cannot read, Ray. Okay, if you would please come forward, and Linda Sherman and Teresa, I cannot read the last name, it looks like it may be O'Halloran. Okay.
Chair Brzezinski and committee members, my name is Linda Sherman.
Linda, why don't you hang on just a second? We're going to make sure your testimony gets on as we make a little technical change here. Yeah. Great, thank you. All right, Linda, if you'd like to go and get started.
Okay. My name is Linda Sherman. I am a psychologist in practice in Portland. I'm a member of many esteemed organizations, but I want to make clear that I'm here today based on my own views and the literature in the field of psychology that has a lot to offer us. I'm a scientific practitioner, which means that I always rely on the literature in the field of psychology to guide my practice. I'm here today to shed light for you on the research findings that are now available to assist policy making in the best interest of children. I am in support of this bill as it would allow us, with confidence, to promote parenting time arrangements that will improve children's lives and promote their longevity. Thank you for providing me with this opportunity to testify. I want to thank William Fabricius of Arizona State University for providing me with a pre-publication copy of some groundbreaking research upon which I will rely today. This research is soon to be published in a book entitled Parenting Time Evaluations, edited by Kathleen Coonley and Leslie Droz. I apologize to my colleagues in my field who might be here today who have not had an opportunity to review this research as it's just out as of this month. Thanks to Dr. Fabricius, we now have striking evidence about the relationships between parenting time and children's health outcomes. I have put together a very simple house to signify what I think we all would agree to, which is at the ceiling of this house, we are all in the business of wanting to promote health for children. I think at the foundation of any house, we now can see that creating, going up the house from the foundation to the ceiling, that we have some things that we can do. Clearly, we know a lot about conflict and how conflict has not been good for children of dissolution. The good news about conflict is that it does remit in about 2 to 3 years, and we can do something with the interventions we now have available to us to be able to promote conflict resolution. Many of us are mediators in the field, and we know that well. We also know that we need responsive parents. We have excellent parent education programs now that can assist parents in becoming more responsive. And many parents inherently know about responsiveness. It's independent of anything else in terms of it ensuring increased emotional security for children. What is new in this model is, and let's flip, go two pages, please, is that we now have identified a pathway for children to help increase resilience and emotional security through parenting time. And if you start at the bottom of this slide, what we know is that increased parent availability allows for more parent-child interaction. And in Dr. Fabricius's research, it has become clear that an independent factor is now available to us to increase children's security, thereby producing long-term health outcomes. Even further, we can see from his research that we have identified how much time is enough. And this is a very simple slide because we've graphed the emotional security, which then leads to resilience, which then leads to positive health outcomes across the amount of parenting time. And the graph speaks for itself. As parenting time increases up to and leveling off at 50%, we get more emotionally secure children. Finally, in conclusion, the courts can play a role in this by ensuring from the outset that they do whatever they can to ensure long-term health consequences. There is no evidence in the literature to date that dual residences are harmful. And there's no one-size-fits-all. Certainly in cases of abuse and domestic violence, which occur at about 20% of families, things can be done so that the court can mitigate against a dual resident for a child who is in danger. But in general, conflict limits over a short period of time, but limiting parenting time seldom repairs up until and inclusive of adulthood. So if a parent-child relationship is not ensured from the outset, catching up later is virtually impossible. So strong relationships with both parents from the beginning actually provide an interesting outcome in buffering the effects of conflict, which I've already stated remit in about 2 to 3 years. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I went ahead and gave you additional time since you're setting the framework, at least from my perspective of what I saw. But for the others, if you could limit your testimony to 3 minutes, that would be wonderful.
Chair Pozanski and members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Teresa O'Halloran. I'm a resident of Portland, Oregon, and a constituent of Senator Bonamici's. I thank you for the opportunity to testify. I served as president of the Oregon Children's Rights Council for 5 years and have been an activist for legislative change for the last 2 years. I'm also a parent. My two boys and I were victims of the system in which one parent is pitted against the other. I was a non-custodial mom with 6 nights per month for 6 years. My children are older teens now, and we now, between my ex-husband and I, we have a shared parenting schedule. The children go between houses freely. We live 1 mile apart, and everything is working well, and the conflict has been minimized, but it took 10 years to get there. You're going to hear today from our opposition, Oregon State Bar, as well as a host of attorneys here in this room, that joint custody is bad for children. What that really means, in my opinion, is that joint custody is bad for domestic relations attorneys. My divorce personally cost me over $200,000 defending against my ex-husband, whose divorce cost him probably close to $400,000. And after following about 2 years, our best friends actually went to a very similar situation with going to attorneys and hearing that their divorce is going to cost in excess of $100,000 to $200,000. And upon my advice, as well as other parents, we encouraged them to do a 50-50 split, exchange on Sundays, do LegalZoom.com for $900. These are very wealthy people that got divorced for minimal exchange of dollars, and all of that money went towards their kids' college fund. So the point is if we can promote shared parenting and joint custody, I think we can minimize the conflict that is bad for kids. In my over the years, I've actually had plenty of opportunity to sit in on court cases. And in 2007, in September, there was a case in front of Judge Catherine Tennyson. And I have to tell you, I was just really impressed with the compassion and the common sense that she used. She asked all the individuals in the room to say who they were. She then pointed to the attorneys and said that she wanted those attorneys to keep the best interests of the children at heart. She also then looked at the parents and said, your schedule is going to be a week on, a week off, and at the end of 3 months, if you're back here, you need to tell me why that didn't work. Those parents to this day have a shared parenting schedule. I believe that it's in the best interest of children of the state to have joint parenting time with both parents, because the best parent is both parents. Thank you.
Chairperson Brzezinski and members of the committee, my name is Nitin Rai. I'm a resident of Portland, Oregon, and I'm also a constituent of Senator Bonamici, who's on this committee. For 3 long years, I've been lobbying for reform in our family law system based on my own personal experience, not too dissimilar from Teresa. My divorce took 2 years. I'm still engaged in a legal battle after the divorce for the last 2 years, and they seem endless. It's created a havoc for me and my children. My children have been hurt by this process, psychologically, emotionally, as well as physically. This process unfairly marginalizes one parent, and I was that parent, based on hearsay in court, based on just testimony from my ex-wife that she was primary, even though I was actively involved. Imagine what that does to the kids when suddenly an active dad is just taken out of their lives. The process does not take into consideration that there are two parents, and that those two parents, healthy parents, can actually work together to take care of their children. As I said, it creates a huge mental and emotional strain for the kids. And as a non-custodial parent, I can't even take them to a doctor or a therapist. The opposition is fighting this bill to preserve status quo. And I can say that from experience in terms of the amount of money that has cost me and my ex-wife in this divorce process and ongoing. As they enable this parental conflict, which supports them financially, they really have no interest in the health of the children. And as a matter of fact, some family law attorneys have personally told me, Nitin, let your children fail, because then you can go back and get sole custody. That's not good for my children. I just feel that it's ironic that, you know, the same attorneys that are going to oppose today practice in the state of Washington, where there is joint custody as a presumption. Dr. Sherman already talked about the research. Unfortunately, the court's hands are tied right now. You know, they have to follow the law, which says they have to assign custody to one parent. And that happens in a temporary basis, and once they make those ruling on a temporary basis, it pretty much becomes permanent, because the system supports that. This bill gives family court judges discretion to order joint custody if they would believe it benefits the children, by actually reducing the parental conflict. And I firmly believe that it would reduce the conflict. And it allows the parents to work together through mediation and other means to partake in the joint decision-making for the benefit of the kids. So let's allow the courts to rule in favor of peace and health for the sake of the children, versus a presumption of disruption, which is what is happening right now. We've had enough of this status quo and broken system, and I really urge you to come up with a solution and vote for this bill.
All right. Thank you very much. First, are there any questions? Senator Wissett first.
Thank you for Dr. Sherman. Do you have any current data on the current court trends in awarding custody? Is it still primarily going to the female partner of the dissolved marriage? Or is there a change to a more equity?
It is, despite the changes that should have occurred over the course of time, the predominant decision-making does remain with moms about 80% of the time.
About 80%. Thank you.
any other questions? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank my constituents for coming and giving your testimony. Teresa, you'd mentioned something in your testimony about the case that you observed with Judge Tennyson, and I'm really interested in that because it sounds like in that instance, even under the existing statute, she made it work. So can you talk a little bit about whether you've seen that in other cases other than the one you brought up in your testimony? Because it looks like if you have a judge who's willing to work with the parties, you can really make it work under the existing statute.
Under existing statute, again, I'm not an attorney, but under existing statute, the judge cannot rule in joint custody. However, what this judge did was she gave sort of a pseudo joint custody on a temporary basis, hoping that that would be enough incentive. As she spoke to the room, she basically said, "If you come back into this courtroom, I will have to assign custody to one of you." And she basically said, "That doesn't mean it's going to be you, Mom, or you. I'm going to decide what's best for the children, and I believe that it's in your best interest for you both to decide what's best for your kids." You know, had we had that situation in my divorce, you know, maybe that would have been enough to persuade my ex-husband to not fight so hard for custody or not actually file false accusations. That happens to be one of the most prolific issues right now. And because of the sole custody statute in our state, that actually encourages parents to file things like a FAPA. Whoever beats the other person at the courthouse with a FAPA or with a false accusation is the one that will usually get temporary custody. And Senator Cruz, I see you nodding there. You've obviously had a personal experience with that. But this is a prolific problem in our state. It's actually a problem throughout the country.
Can I add something to her, Senator Bonamici?
It's up to the chair.
Sure.
My own personal experience, in my case, my judge did not order temporary custody to either parent, but she gave my ex-wife final say if there were disagreements. We had no disagreements on legal, on education, health, and so on and so forth. But what she did at the same time was she marginalized me with no overnights and three contacts every other week for 3 hours, which was really disruptive. And it also, what it did was it set a precedent. So when we went in for a custody evaluator, he looked at it and he goes, "Well, you know, Mom should get custody and Mom should get majority time." End of story. And the judge followed that. So even though some judges are trying to, during the temporary period, they're trying to do something to allow parents to mediate, the law, as it's written, it has their hands tied. And I think that's where we have the problem. And I think this bill, if is approved into law, it's going to dramatically change how custody rulings are made, and also how parenting time is assigned.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to maybe counsel who was gone from this discussion to clarify, because just so that the record's clear, it's not that the court can't order joint custody now. If both parents agree.
All right. Thank you all very much for coming forward. Our second group is going to be Janice Garcia Ken, I cannot read the last name, I apologize, Judith Swinney, and Brad Leachman. I apologize.
It's okay. Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Janice Garceau, and I am not a lawyer. I am a social worker. I have worked with kids for 20 years and with families in contested custody proceedings for 8 of those 20 years. I manage family court services, I'm part of the state FLAC, and a number of other committees that look at these issues. And I'm really going to focus on wading through the research because I really believe that the committee is being presented with information that is confusing, and I want to clarify some things. First of all, this bill doesn't address parenting time. It addresses legal decision-making, and that is what custody is in Oregon, as you probably are aware. Many, many, many families have sole legal custody with one parent and shared parenting time or other versions of parenting time. So to lump those two issues together, I really think confuses what this bill is intended to address. Second of all, the courts absolutely can order joint custody when the parents agree, and I know for a fact, because we mediate in our program with about 1,000 families a year that never go to court, that frequently reluctantly, parents agree. The research absolutely supports that when parents agree to joint custody, there are strong benefits for children. However, there is very recent research. It is very compelling. It is referred to in the state FLAC document that you have in front of you. That shows that when parents do not agree and are compelled to share custody, conflict between parents increases. And we know from research, 30 years of research, that when conflict increases, children do not fare well. It is, in fact, one of the most negative impacts of divorce and separation. So I think it's very important for the committee, as they look at this issue, to distinguish between compelled joint custody arrangements and custody arrangements that parents have voluntarily entered into. They're very different scenarios. The situation for families is changing, and the truth, Senator Whitsitt, is that when that parenting time arrangements are in very that when you talk about 80% of arrangements being with moms, that reflects the population that mutually agrees. In contested custody proceedings, there's actually evidence that it is about a 50-50 decision-making rate, and in fact, when there have been allegations of abuse or domestic violence, the court is now ruling more in favor of the person who was alleged to be the abuser, and there is some literature about that. So I think that's another point to really clarify. There's a real difference in the statistics depending on whether there's agreement or not. The reason that the Oregon legislature has looked at this issue over and over again over the years and come down with the same decision has not been to maintain the status quo. Very informed work groups who care a great deal about children have made a decision that when parents can't agree, somebody does need to have final say, because otherwise kids are involved in ongoing litigation, and that's not good for kids. So, with that said, I again strongly encourage you to take a look at the document that the State FLAC Subcommittee put together. It was a broadly represented group. It was not all attorneys. It was a group of people who care very much about outcomes for children and see real-life kids in front of them all the time. And I think it's a useful piece of information. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Who wants to go next? Judith?
Yes. Thank you. My name is Judith Swinney, and I work in Portland with parents in high conflict, parents who are divorcing or divorced. I have for the past 10 years. So I'm here as a parent educator and a mediator. This morning I heard on the radio, can you hear me?
Yes, we're fine.
Thank you. I heard on the radio a congressman from Washington talking about the gridlock that's ensuing over the federal budget. His comment was, if it's not bipartisan, it won't last. And I think that's an analogy that we can apply to the situation here. When there's conflict between parents, but one parent has sole legal custody, at least decisions can be made. If parents have joint legal custody and don't agree, decisions won't be made, leaving children left with decisions not made for them and on their behalf. As has been stated before, this bill is about the legal custody of kids, solely the decision making. If parents can't agree, they're going to have to turn to the courts. More attorneys, not less, will be needed because of the floodgate of litigation, mm-hmm. especially since this bill is retroactive. Anybody with an outcome of sole legal custody in a contested case can go back to court and challenge that finding. So there will be more need for attorneys, more delays in the court, and other family law matters will face further delays. I from Texas, and I guess I could say that dog don't hunt. I'm not going to say that, but I'm going to say...
Go right ahead, the chair's moving.
Okay. Well, I don't know if it's going to hunt, but I'd say be careful with what it's going to bring back, because there may be unintended consequences. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Senator Prezansky and the other senators, pleasure to be here today. My name's Brad Lechman-Sue. I am from the law firm Lechman-Sue and Quash, but my testimony today isn't representative of my partner, I agree with the bar's position, but it's my own independent conclusion that causes me to agree with that. I've been practicing family law since 1991. I remember writing a paper for my family law professor in law school in 1985 on presumption of joint legal custody. And so I had that in my mind all these years and have been watching that. I also serve as a pro tem judge in Washington County, and I hear appeals of FAPA restraining orders. So I've seen this from a lot of different angles, and I also represent children in my practice besides custody litigants. It was said that joint custody is being presented as being bad for children, and that's not true. It's good when it works. My experience over the years has been that when parents can agree, it's great for children, and all the research supports that. The question here and the question today is, how do you promote that? I have a lot to say, but limited time. I have a couple technical things I want to say, so I'm going to conclude my overall position about this type of legislation. As Abraham Maslow, who once said, self-discovery is the most important and the most powerful kind of learning. Now, Dr. Sherman and Ms. O'Halloran both said that it takes years sometimes for the conflict to die down. Well, if that's the case, if the conflict dies down in a few years, people have learned to cope with that, and then they're excellent parents. But in the meantime, we can't have them fighting with imposed legal custody. From a technical standpoint, I would like to say that the temporary measures under Section 1, parents have equal rights of custody in Oregon when they're married parents. If they're not married parents, it's a bit more complicated, but until a court orders otherwise, there is joint legal custody. So Section 1 is completely redundant. We don't need that. Also, I have to support what Ms. Swinney said about the retroactivity of the amendments, is that would open a significant amount of custody litigation. And that's Section 3 of the Senate bill. The first one I spoke about was Section 1 of the House bill. And I have appeared in front of Judge Tennyson because I practice in Multnomah County. I've appeared in front of her many times, and I've seen her and many other judges not award legal custody pendente lite during the case to see how the parents do, to let things die down a bit. Sometimes it works, and it comes out at the end that the parents agree. Sometimes it doesn't, and it takes more years. This bill would take that flexibility and impose that in many circumstances. It's not a good idea.
All right. Thank you. All right. Questions for anyone on the panel? Well, doesn't look like maybe I could say thank you very much for being here, and also just for my alma mater that won last night, the women's basketball, Texas A&M. The best part of the game was at the end when the coach was talking. It just took me back home. So with that, thank you all very much for coming up.
You're welcome. Waggy
Sunshine.
Thank
you all.
What can I say? All right, so we have our next panel, and what I have here is I have Philip Cook, Matt Menahan, and then I have listed Mac Family, so I don't know if that's a person or multiple people. Okay, so what I'm going to do is the first two, y'all come on up. We'll have you as another panel as a unit or as a family.
Senator Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Matt Menahan. I represent Oregon Association for Children's and Family Services and Dad's America. Given the amount of testimony today, I'm going to be extremely brief. The only thing I want to point out about this bill is it is, the way we understand it, it allows judicial discretion for joint custody when two parents don't agree. I would point out, I would make a statement to say, don't be fooled by our opposition in that this is a broad presumption. This bill is taking a look at allowing the judge to take a look at individual cases, case by case, and make a determination if joint custody would fit in that particular situation. And it just allows the judicial discretion. You know, people ask me what the toughest thing I've ever done in my life is, and I've done a number of things. My answer is I worked a paternity bill here many years ago, which some of you were involved in, and that particular bill actually took away judicial discretion. It said if you had A, B, or C, the judge had a rule in a certain way. There are a number of people who are actually testify against me today who I respect greatly and work with a number of years, and I appreciate because they always include me in the discussions. But they will testify today against judicial discretion, which is surprising to me. I would be very interested in their answer if you were to ask them, in a particular case, if the judge makes a decision, any decision, and one of those parents happen to disagree with that decision that the judge makes, should that parent have the ability to overrule that decision? If you would ask them that, I, for one, would be very interested in their answer. I'm going to close with, we all agree that joint custody is good when it works. You've heard that statement a lot today. It's good when it works. We firmly believe this bill allows it to work. In cases where it would work and the judge sees that it would work in this particular case, this allows the judge to make that determination for that particular case. And that is our argument here today. And I'll close with that and take any questions you might have.
All right, thank you.
Hi, allow me to introduce myself. I had a tough thing to do last month. I was told to write a letter to the President of the United States as a member of a national commission.
You go ahead and put your name on the record.
Oh, sure. My name is Philip Cook. I was told I had to write a letter to the President of the United States and introduce myself. The trouble was the darn thing was going to be actually read by the Chief of Staff because the proposal was endorsed by the Boy Scouts of America and he was spoken to personally about this. So that was pretty tough. So I thought I'd sort of double dip the sweat and read part of that letter of introduction. I've been a broadcast news director in America's small and large cities for about 20 years. 15 years ago, I left an award-winning career in order to dedicate myself to public service. The core of that public service was to more readily embrace best practices and outcome results. But I needed to focus on something, and I realized that the central focus needed to be fragile families, because that's the most critical issue facing society today. And within that, I have been successful in my state, Oregon, in getting legislation approved about 15 years ago or so that mandated children of divorce classes for all divorcing parents with minor children. Lots of help from Oregon Health Sciences University, Family Nursing, Channel 2, Channel 8, good members of this committee, and so on. Now, that has reduced discord within the fractured family, and considering children first has enhanced post-separation contact with both parents. Now, that legislation was opposed by the family law section of the state bar at the time and by legal aid and others, saying that that would increase domestic violence, for example. And it hasn't happened. It hasn't even enhanced the possibility of it, as the various judges in the counties have introduced and mandated the children divorce classes. And I would say that, you know, it's pretty draconian that a judge has the authority to impose joint custody over the objections of one parent. But, you know, 90% of the parents who attend the children divorce classes, they resent going. But 90%, when they get out, go, hey, that was a pretty darn good thing. You know, so it's a tough thing to do. But I would sort of urge this step as a first step, really, in the ultimate goal. Now, the ultimate goal ought to be getting parents out of the adversarial court system entirely. That should be the ultimate goal of, hopefully, this legislation and this legislature. We're asking, basically, courts to do what family therapists have a tough time dealing with themselves. And certainly attorneys, it's a win it's a win-or-lose situation. We know one thing, that regardless of who wins or loses in an adversarial court system, certainly one party loses, and that's the children. That's a certainty. Now, you know, let me just read something from the New Hampshire Supreme Court.
I need you to go ahead and wrap
sure.
up with that.
Sure. Continuing great. Deep and rich relationships with both parents are in the child's best interest. And the judge has that discretion to promote that. And even in a high conflict situation, then the children end up better off. So thank you very much for your time, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And anyone have any questions for Mr. Clerk? Thank you very much. Our next panel is going to be Tammy Dittinger, Sybil Hebb, and Ryan Carty. Whoever would like to get started.
Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, my name is Tammy Dittinger. I'm a lawyer in private practice here in Marion County. I'm a shareholder in the law firm of Garrett Heyman Robertson. I limit my practice to exclusive domestic relations cases and have for the past 16 years. I'm also a fellow of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, past chair of the family law section of the Marion County, the Oregon State Bar, Marion County Bar Association, and serve as a pro tem judge over pro se, no lawyer, divorce cases here in Marion County on a regular basis. I am appearing on behalf of myself here today. I think there's a misunderstanding as to what sole versus joint custody does. Joint custody allows the parents to have equal decision-making authority in all issues. When my clients ask me what sole custody does, I say it allows one parent to have final decision-making authority on non-emergency medical care. Do your kids get ADHD medication? Do they not? It allows you to have final decision-making authority on educational decisions. Does the kid, what school does the children go to? Do they skip a grade? Do they get held back? Do they go special ed? Do they go to talented and gifted? It doesn't stop the non-custodial parent from going to school, talking to the teachers, having lunch at the school, gaining all the information and providing all the input they want to on the final decision. It doesn't stop the non-custodial parent from taking the child to the doctor on their watch if they fall off the jungle gym and break their arm. Doesn't stop them from authorizing emergency medical care. Doesn't stop them from going to doctor's appointments, to talking to counselors, to gaining information and providing all the input they want to in all those decision-making issues. It just gives one parent the final decision-making authority in that small window of issues. It's not at all uncommon in a family law case to see a parent have sole custody but a equal parenting time schedule, meaning we've designated one parent to make a final decision in these few issues, but we're going to allow the kids to have equal access to both parents on a regular basis. So joint versus sole custody is a very emotionally charged word. It has an emotional and social stigma that people fight very hard for. But what it really does is very limited issues, keeps parents from fighting over their children in a couple of different ways. There was a judge in the Coast a long time ago. I was at a presentation. He says he's never seen two good parents in a contested custody matter. Two good parents will work it out. Two good parents will put their issues aside and make a decision that's best for their children. So when you're having a contested custody fight, you either have one parent who is involved in parent control or manipulation that can't let it go, or sometimes two bad parents who are both embattled in the fight and you're choosing of the lesser of the two evils. Good parents are going to make decisions for their kids. Good parents aren't going to spend $200,000 to $400,000 on attorneys fighting over that. Those are parents who can't get along, who are going to continue to use their children as weapons against each other. And by forcing them into a situation where they have to make joint decisions, the children are the only ones that are being hurt. I advocate for joint custody. I think joint custody is a great thing. I think when it works wonderfully, and children are very healthy. And it works in the vast majority of the cases. I would say probably two-thirds of my cases we agree on joint custody. We're seeing parenting time become much more expansive, more generous than parenting time. But joint custody only works when the parents are thinking about their children, not in their battles with the other parent. And by forcing them into that thing, you're just going to create more work for me.
Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Carty. I am an attorney in Salem in private practice, strictly limited to family law. I am the legislative liaison for the family law section of the Oregon State Bar, and I also co-chair the bar's legislative subcommittee. I appear today in my official capacities with the bar in opposition of Senate Bill 334. There have been a lot of good points made, and I just want to reaffirm that distinction between legal and physical, legal custody and physical custody. And as practitioners, that's one of the first things and most difficult things we do, is to make that distinction in the minds of our clients, because it is a huge, huge source of misinformation. Folks come in and think, if I lose custody, I'm never going to see my children. That's simply not true. The court currently, as the law stands right now, has absolute authority to order any parenting time plan, any split of time between the parents that the court sees fit, based on a best interests of the children determination. This bill does not impact parenting time one bit. It deals solely with the legal custody. I think enough points have been made about that. The literature that Dr. Scher indicated, I don't think is particularly groundbreaking, at least in the review of what the family law section deals with. We review the psychological literature relating to children, relating to best interests of the children, and it's absolutely true. Children who have parents who can work together have better outcomes, better emotional and better health in the long term. The problem with a lot of studies that we see in these psychological reports, though, is that they mix parents who have voluntary joint custody with parents from the small minority of states that have mandated joint custody, and they say, as a broad statement, children from homes that have joint custody do better. Well, that's true, because the vast majority of children in homes of parents who have joint custody are in homes where the parents have agreed to joint custody. That's why the children do better, because they have two parents who are willing to work together. This bill says, despite the fact that neither one of you, or at least one of you, doesn't want to work with the other one, we're going to force you to. That is going to create conflict, and with all due respect to the testimony you heard about the fees that attorneys charge, I can tell you without any hesitation that forced joint custody will increase litigation. In fact, it's going to be nothing but a litigation generator. In my written testimony, I've set forth a number of examples about how to deal with various situations. One of those is, let's say parent A, in a joint custody situation, wants the children to go to a private school and says, I'm willing to pay for it. Parent B says, nope, I went to public school and I love public schools. I think we really need to support our public schools. By gosh, let's get involved. Let's get our kids in there to public school. All of a sudden, we have two parents who don't agree. They can't agree. We're going to go right back to court and have the judge decide. Because the parents who can agree do. We see it over and over and over. Professor Graham from Willamette University is here today. She's going to talk to you about...
Ryan, I need you to wrap up.
Thank you very much. The last comment I will make is on a technical issue, and that's a practical concern. As the law currently stands, a party who seeks to do away with a court's order of joint custody, if the parties do agree to joint custody at the beginning of the case and their original divorce decree does order joint custody, one party can show a significant change of circumstances and ask for a modification simply by saying they have an inability or unwillingness to continue to cooperate. This bill makes no change in that law. So in other words, what this bill would do would be allow the court to impose joint custody and allow parents to then, as soon as the very next day, go back to court and say, I have an inability or unwillingness to cooperate, and they're right back in court. Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Civil.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Civil Head with the Oregon Law Center. I'm also here to express concern about Senate Bill 334. I echo the comments of the opponents who have come before me, and I would say from the Law Center's perspective, we provide free legal services to low-income people, so our services are not generating fees. But joint custody generates problems for our clients, and we end up going to court and needing to go help people resolve cases where the parents couldn't decide when joint custody has been imposed and it's no longer working. So I think I agree that imposing joint custody on a specific category of people who have been unable to come to a determination that they can make decisions together ends up creating conflict that results in clogging of the court systems and takes up time and puts kids in the middle of conflict. And so that's one of the reasons that we're concerned. I also wanted to just draw your attention to how much work Oregon does to try to help parents come to agreement. We provide mediation services that are required, and they're free, and they're available through the courthouses. You heard from some of the people who provide those services earlier today. We also provide, in our statutory structure, significant encouragement of parenting plans and the development of parenting plans that involve parents equally and to great extent in their children's lives. And we have developed forms, the Judicial Department has developed self-help forms that are available on their website that ask a series of questions and help parents come up with parenting plans that will help facilitate time with children. That's just another way that parents can access service to help them maintain that contact. There's also a divorcing parents class that is provided in every community in the state that teaches parents about what are the impacts of conflict on your children, how is it that we can learn to get along, and what the benefits are of coming to decisions together. And so I think Mr. Lichtman-Sue previously testified, and I agree, that it is really great when parents can agree. And we ought to do all we can to help them get to that point. But when parents, even with all of this assistance that we provide them, are not able to come to agreement, forcing them to enter into a legal custody situation which requires every decision to be made jointly is just simply bad for children. In my opinion, if we were to do anything to try to facilitate this situation, it would be to put, it's a resource issue, I believe, but I think the more resources we can get to courts and to families who are trying to cope with these issues and trying to negotiate those matters, the better. Forcing them, when they can't come to an agreement, to make decisions together anyway, I wish that it would work, but I don't believe that it does. I also wanted to just draw some attention to the other states in the nation that have grappled with this. There's a small minority of states that have a presumption that would allow an imposition of joint custody over parents' objections. It's a minority, and it used to be a bigger minority. It's getting smaller. California was the pioneer in establishing this joint custody presumption, and they've repealed their law because they found that it didn't work. Utah has also joined them in repealing their law. I'll wrap up. The only other thing that I wanted to add was that there have been multidisciplinary groups looking at this issue and trying their best to take all of the input into consideration and assess Oregon's current statutory structure, and they have consistently come up with a decision that it does in fact worked best for parents and for children. And there are reports from the Oregon Task Force on Family Law, the Family Law Parenting Plan Workgroup, and the Family Law Advisory Committee Parental Involvement Workgroup that I handed in with my testimony. So I appreciate your time on this issue.
You bet. Thank you very much. Question, Senator Bonamici
first.
Thank
you. I don't have a question. Tammy, I'm sorry I didn't catch your last name.
Dettinger.
Dettinger. I'm just a little bit concerned about one of the statements that,
okay,
in your testimony when you said that good parents won't spend hundreds of thousands of dollars. I know you were probably here when you heard my constituent earlier.
Correct.
Testify, and I just want to make sure that you didn't mean that in any specific instance that wouldn't happen, because if you might have one parent who is willing to spend,
correct,
a significant amount of money and the other parent feels like they need to also fight for their rights. So
And what I meant, Senator Chair Prosansky, Senator Bonamici, is that going back to my final statement is that in a contested custody case that gets before a judge, as I one of the judges from the Keith said, there aren't two good parents. There might be one parent who has to pony up a ton of money to defend themselves and to defend their children. That happens, and I'm not going to tell you that's not uncommon. But in that situation, you're not going to see two good parents spend $600,000 fighting over custody, because two good parents would have found a way to resolve it and to work for themselves. You might have one parent who has to spend much money to defend themselves and their children, but that's an enormous amount of money. In my practice, I have not ever even heard of a case costing that amount of money, and I've had some high conflict families in front of me, so I can only imagine the conflict that would exist in a case that would generate that kind of fees.
Thank you. I just wanted that clarified.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I read this bill, it provides the option for a judge to award joint custody when the parents can't decide. It does not compel awarding joint custody.
So are judges generally not competent to use judicial discretion to decide what may be best for the children? I mean, is that your testimony, that we, that judges shouldn't have the discretion?
Senator Prozanski, Senator Whitsitt, as a general rule, we can't legislate parents to be good parents and to get along and to be nice, and we can't order them in a court order to get along and to be good parents and to get along. What my personal opinion is that if a court, with all of their great wisdom, thinks that this family can get to a point where they can be joint custodial parents, even though one parent is, I can't work with this parent, we're not going to get along, we are legislating and ordering, compelling parents to behave themselves. That, I would love for us to have the power to do that. That's why I have a job, is because people generally can't. So what we're asking that judge to do is to get out their crystal ball, hope this family can get along, but make the decisions on school, make the decisions on medical decisions if the parents can't do that. What I find and what I believe is probably a better way is the natural attrition of people as the passion and the hurt and the pain subsides over months, years, decades, some families, is that parents do come to a point where they can get along and come closer to joint custody as time goes by. But the compelling people to behave themselves and to get along and not fight with their ex-spouse or ordering them to simply does not work.
Follow up.
Yes, thank you. I'm not sure that answered the question.
Okay.
The question is, do you believe that the judges are not competent to make that decision? Just yes or no?
No.
Thank you.
And if I may respond, Senator Prozanski.
Very, very quickly.
Thank you. And Senator Whitsett, this is a policy issue, absolutely, that the legislature needs to weigh in on. And the concern is that, unfortunately, if we do present that option to courts, that there are going to be cases where that's imposed as a feel-good mechanism rather than something that's actually going to work in practice.
So your answer would be no as well, that they don't generally do the best thing for the children?
No, I do believe, and I think the bar's position would be, that judges do exactly what's in the best interest of the children as much as possible. The problem is that this opens up a discretion into an area that is simply unmanageable.
All right. Thank you all very much for coming forward. My next panel is the Mack family.
Ready?
Yes.
Okay. Hi, I'm John Mock, and good morning to you, Senator Prozanski, and the committee members. To my left here is Brian Mock, my son, and Catherine, also known as KT Mock, my daughter. And we are very happy to talk to you today. We're members of a divorced family. Oh, my gosh. After the last sets of testimony, I can hardly wait to speak here. First of all, we're 6 years divorced. I started out with 25% time with the kids. Within a year, they were complaining that was just an awful, awful schedule, and they started asking for full, half time with each parent. And it was a horrendous uphill battle. The total cost of the divorce after 6 years, most of it in the earlier years, $250,000. Two-thirds for me, one-third for my ex-wife. The process of getting from 25% to 50-50 for us, with the kids supporting me, with the support of a lawyer, with the support of a parenting evaluator, $101,000 is filed with the court. And again, that was $41,000 for my wife and $60,000 for me. It's horrendously, horrendously expensive for a non-custodial parent to fight uphill, even with the support of their kids. And frankly, we have nothing to gain. We're at 50-50 here. But we had such a horrendous experience, we don't want other people to suffer. And we think that SB 334 is a good bill. It gives judges discretion to make a decision. And so having started there, let me just say this is a big issue. There are, and I've put as many useful statistics in my paper as I possibly could, because there's a lot of hand-waving, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence. People will tell you one anecdote and want you to believe that somehow it represents the majority. My best guess is, and it is an estimate, 1.8 million people in the state of Oregon are affected as divorced families. That's 46% of the population. And frankly, that's consistent with what we hear anecdotally. About half of the families are experiencing divorce. Now, I think there's something interesting here. There's a lot of social change in our society. We're not no longer dealing with mom stays at home. We've got dad stays at home. Two working parents, both of whom share care for the kids. We have gay and lesbian couples who are adopting or have kids and getting divorced at about the same rate as everybody else. We've had immense social change in the last 40 years, and yet we're still handing out sort of the one-size-fits-all kind of policies. Your parenting time is going to be 25 or 30% if you're a non-custodial parent. Doesn't matter how much money you spend, it's probably going to end up pretty close to that. So my point is, this restores the ability of both parents to start on an even playing field. And that's fairly important, and I know I'm limited in time here, so I'm going to skip some of what I put in here, but I would ask you please, you know, I've tried very hard to put useful things in here for you. Please read this. But let me hit on something. We've had a lot of stories about unfortunate experiences and the law and such. I think there's some public policy issues that are very important. So as an example, my best estimate based on Oregon State Bar data and other data available is that this is a $168 million a year industry. $168 million a year. And I think that number may actually be low. I'm just trying to be conservative. But in a study by Richard Kuhn and John Guidobaldi in 1997, they found that as parenting time went toward 50-50, in other words, they looked at all the states and looked at the parenting time data, in states which had a much higher incidence, you know, approaching 50-50 parenting time, divorce rates fell. And I thought that was interesting. And so let's put this into some numbers for you. And again, you know, there are difficulties working with data, but I believe if you went to 50-50, you could see divorce rates in Oregon fall by 4 to 10%. Now, that's important because this $168 million a year is a tax on divorcing families. It's money that could have gone, that $250,000 easily would have funded the education of my kids. I think the first thing is, as you go to 50-50, parents start thinking, well, do I really want to get a divorce? You know, if I have to share the kids, if I have to share the decision-making, maybe it isn't worth it. And I think that's important because maybe parents will go back, and as these judges are sometimes saying, you know, let's give you a month to think about it, well, maybe if they thought about it before they got to court, it'd be even better. And I think that's an important point.
John, I need you to wrap up.
Sorry. Just one more important point here. Robert Bowserman did a study on the adjustment of children versus in joint custody versus sole custody. And what he found is, you know, as we all know, kids who are in sole custody families have a lot more emotional, physical, crime, drug abuse, etc. and again, what he also found, though, is in families with joint custody, the kids adjusted to life about as well as they do it as in an intact family. I think that's really significant because, again, we're talking about if you don't have to pay $50,000 a year for a kid who's been convicted of some crime because they grew up in a broken family, we're literally looking at millions. I mean, I think I could be talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. And, again, it's in here. Please read it.
You will.
I'll let my kids talk.
Brian?
Hello, Chairman Pruzanski, members of the committee. Brian Mock, OSU student, chemical engineering, semiconductor worker, all that cool stuff. I think the big thing really for me that I want to reiterate is just how much of an uphill battle it was having, you know, a custodial parent and a non-custodial parent because, again, after a short amount of time with this, you know, we had every Wednesday and every other weekend with our dad, you know, we said, we don't like this, you know, we want to change it. And so, but it just took forever. I mean, we had to go to, you know, parenting coordinators, wrote some letters to judges. I even went to my mom herself and said, I want equal time with my dad. And yet, even after all this, even after telling him my best interest, I think that's the buzzword of the day. I said, this is what I want, and this is what I think will be best for me and best for our family. And even after that, it was a battle forever, you know, tons of money involved, and it just took forever, you know, years and years to finally reach this point of, of having equal time with our parents, which is what we wanted from, you know, damn near the beginning, excuse my French. And so I think that's just really the big thing to say. And, you know, while I'm on the subject, I also want to say, though, that, you know, the comment that, you know, good parents won't fight and spend all this money, I find that insulting. You know, even though my parents couldn't agree and they did spend all this money, they're still both good parents. You know, I love both of them. And, you know, and yes, that has, you know, we don't have as much money for college and stuff like that. But, you know, okay, so I work more. I spend more time in my lab working, making money so I can go to college. You know, it's not the end of the world. And, again, I think, again, that the accusation that these good parents wouldn't fight is just absolute trash, and I find it insulting to both of my parents. And that's really the mainstay of what I want to say on that one. And I'll pass it over to my co-pilot, Catherine, here.
Hi, KT.
Hello, committee council. I am, also a freshman at Oregon State.
I need you to just put your name on the record, please.
Catherine Mock.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, Catherine Mock. And I am, yes, a child of divorce, and I too have heard already many times today that we are working in the best interests of the children, so what better way to understand the best interest than to hear from children of divorce themselves? So that's why we're here today. I don't believe it was right for us to get 25% time with my dad and more time with my mom. I don't believe it was right to grant more power to the custodial parent than to the non-custodial parent, because just as my brother said, we both saw them as equal in parenting ability and we loved them just as much, and there was no reason to grant more power to one parent than to the other. And so, I mean, really, the worst you could accuse my father of is not getting to spend as much time with us as he would like because he was working to support us fiscally, and that doesn't seem so horrible to me. So it was very difficult working for 50-50 time with my father. And while we did have sole custody and we did eventually get 50-50 time, it took a long time to achieve that. And when more power is granted to one parent over the other, they're not likely to be interested in giving up some of that power to the other parent and giving up some of that time to the other parent. So it's difficult to get them to acquiesce to that equality. And so I believe it's important to grant joint custody, and that's why I support it. So, really, it kind of, the situation we were in, it set us against the system that we were trying to work with. So we ended up working against it, really, and it against us. And it also set us against our mother a little bit too, because we had to fight against something that she didn't necessarily agree with, and that's how it was set up.
Okay, well, thank you very much. First, let's see if there's any questions. Thank you all very much for coming up today, and glad to hear that you're at the Land Grant School. All right. It's not my district, but I went to one myself. So all right, so I've got one other panel, the Bill Howe, Catherine Graham, and Margaret One. And I am going to need to keep y'all to no more than 3 minutes each, because I still have work sessions to do. Who'd like to go first?
I'll go first.
Okay.
And I'll try to keep it very brief.
Thank you.
My name is Kathy Graham. Not Catherine Graham, unfortunately, but Kathy Graham. I teach at Willamette. I've taught family law at Willamette for 34 years, and I like to think I have my hand on the pulse of what's going on nationally and also in Oregon. I'm very interested in Oregon law and how things develop in Oregon. And I don't want to go through all of the details of what we've talked about today. I just can probably add a couple of things that maybe haven't already been said. With respect to, of course, joint legal and joint residential, we're talking in terms of this bill about the determination of the joint legal custody. In Oregon, in its 107-169 and its 107-102, I think makes it very clear that where possible, we're going to encourage people to have joint decision-making authority over their children. And in research that I've done nationally, I've found that, and I think this would probably be true in Oregon as well, where couples can agree, we all agree that it makes sense for the, from the children's perspective that joint decision-making authority be the method of choice with respect to post-divorce kinds of arrangements. And nationally, in studies that I've looked at, and there's some information in my prepared testimony about this, it looks as though about 70 to 75% of divorcing couples, whether they're mediating, whether they're going through some kind of settlement process, or even those that end up in litigation, end up just overall with joint decision-making authority at a rate of about 70 to 75%. So we're talking here today about the other couples, the ones that haven't been able to work it out. And in Oregon, of course, we have a lot of encouragement in our system for people to work it out. So our, I would suspect that our rate of joint decision-making kind of selection by couples at divorce is high, is at least 70%. I mean, with the mediation program that we have, with the kinds of education program we have for divorcing parents, I have no doubt that we're moving in the direction of encouraging people where it works out. But there's a fork in the road here, and there are families and parents where this just isn't meant to be, where they're having difficulty working out these details. And from my perspective, having looked at the research, it appears to me, from the standpoint of the best interest of the children, it's best to keep them in a situation where one parent has that sole decision-making authority where the parents can't agree. But I think we should be working in the direction of trying to have those parents work it out. Now, there's another...
I'm going to wrap up.
Okay, I'm going to wrap up. I've got one other point that I wanted to make, and it's in my written material. Where you do have a kind of coerced joint legal custody, I've pointed out some cases from other jurisdictions and some just thoughts about the fact that what are you going to do when the people can't agree? I think a couple of the other witnesses talked about this today. You've got to either have a court, a mediator, or you've got to go to a default sole custody decision-making kind of model. So in that kind of situation, you're faced with more costs and a more difficult kind of arrangement. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill. Good morning, Senator Prusansky and members of the committee. My name is Bill Howe. I'm a partner with Gewurz, Menasche, Larson, and Howe. We're 21 lawyers. We do nothing but family law. And in an earlier life, I was the chair of the Oregon Task Force on Family Law, and I can tell you that the Oregon State Bar, Legal Aid, and many others were strongly in support of things like parent education class. In fact, the 12 bills that task force generated, most of which were passed unanimously by this legislatively created task force, and Mr. Taylor remembers this well when both of our hair had less gray in it. Almost all passed unanimously, and it created the architecture for the current family law system, and this very issue was discussed back then. The first time I've testified on this issue was in 1987. And what we're talking about is, can the court impose joint decision-making on people, at least one of whom disagrees? That's like saying, all right, you two own a piece of property together. One of you wants to get out, the other one doesn't, and the court says, no, you're going to stay in it. The court judge has no jurisdiction to do that if you're partitioning real property. 50-50 owners of a corporation come in. I want to dissolve the corporation. We can't agree on how. The court has no jurisdiction to do anything other than order it sold or partitioned. That's what we're talking about here. Take people who can't agree and order them to agree. The last panel of very nice folks were talking about their argument, and almost all they discussed is parenting time. This bill has nothing to do with parenting time. This is decision-making. That gentleman was talking about spending $60,000 to $100,000 in attorney's fees. Now, if you order them to agree, all of a sudden they're going to agree? No. What they're going to do is they're going to come back to court. And they're going to come back to court, if you read Section 3, with all of the people who have been ordered sole custody now and now have an automatic right, because there's a finding that this is a substantial change in circumstances, which is the key to the door for modification of custody. So who are we talking about? 98% of cases, family law cases in Oregon, settle. So we're talking about 2%. Of those that are litigated, the last figures in Multnomah County, 50% of custody cases, 50% went to dad. There's a very small subset of cases that are litigated. The ones that are litigated typically involve domestic violence, chemical abuse, you know, some kind of problem, move away issues, and the rest. So we're going to take the small subset and say, in the most conflict intense cases, we're going to give the court jurisdiction to order joint decision making on people who have demonstrated an inability to jointly decide.
Bill, I need you to wrap up, please.
Makes no sense. That's why people are backing off. And frankly, this, if it passes, and Chair Przanski, 15 seconds, we have six lawyers that practice in Washington. They have a joint custody presumption. Fees up there are way higher. If there's a problem, public, private school, all the rest of it, you immediately go to court within a week. We don't have the budget to do that here.
Thank you very much, Margaret.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Margaret Olney, and I'm an attorney in private practice with experience in family law. And most recently, I was special counsel to Attorney General John Kroger in the child support arena and sort of got immersed in parenting time issues in that capacity. I'm here today speaking solely on my own behalf and opposing this bill, and I just want to raise three points. One is that the concern, I think, is not what happens if we have to go to court, because as Mr. Howe testified, very few parties go to court. The question is, what is the impact of this litigation on the parties before they go to court in terms of leverage and threats and negotiations before? I think that's also a serious impact of this bill. Second is that we have to remember that a large majority of the parties who appear in our court system are self-represented, and I think this bill adds a level of confusion to an already very confusing area for folks to deal with, particularly when they're emotionally distraught. The testimony today in support of this bill demonstrates the problem. Almost all of the witnesses spoke about parenting time issues, joint parenting time issues, thinking that joint custody was going to get them shared equal parenting time, and that's not what this bill is about. Those are two separate issues. What really needs to happen, and it is a question of resources, as Sybil Hebb testified, is that we need to have even more robust family court services and mechanisms in place to facilitate both effective, fair parenting plans that recognize that are age appropriate, that are flexible, and then we need to have services that are available to both modify those as the kids get older and as their changed circumstances, and then as well to enforce them in a way that is meaningful in real time and that really helps the parties focus on the concerns and the welfare of the kids and not create an entrance point for other concerns regarding, for example, economics and how much child support, et cetera, that are often at play in the background in a lot of discussions about custody and parenting time. Right. Thank you.
Margaret, thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you all very much. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 334. We're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 425.
Chairman of the Committee, Senate Bill 425 comes to you from the Committee on the Judiciary. It actually was part of an interim session work group in which Representative Tomei played a very active role. It removes a requirement the state prove that a person charged with compelling a minor to engage in prostitution knew the person being compelled was a minor, and eliminates the defense that the defendant did not know the minor's age or the defendant reasonably believed the minor was older than 18. Applies to conduct occurring after the effective date of the measure takes effect upon passage. Mr. Members of the Committee, after we had the bill drafted and submitted through the Senate Judiciary Committee, we had another work group meeting, and some issues were raised at that time as it relates to aiding or facilitating someone in the commission of compelling prostitution, especially from the district attorney's side, that it would help if the law were expanded to go after people that are facilitating this, not just urging and compelling. So we then got a set of amendments, and then we had concerns from the other side that as it relates to juveniles, that oftentimes the pimp would have the 17-year-old facilitating the 14-year-old, and that would then bring juveniles into the system. So we got one amendment that would take juveniles out of the mandatory 70-month sentence. There was then concerns from the district attorney side that that would then cover a 17-year-old who was really a pimp. So we filed a set of amendments. We have basically it adds the age and facilitates the crime of compelling prostitution. And as it relates to someone 15, 16, or 17 years of age, if they're aiding or facilitating, they're still treated in the juvenile court system. Chair, members of the committee, that's the evolution and the amendments through the process of the original bill. And that's the Dash 4 amendments. We do have the fiscal and the Dash 4.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 425.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 4 amendments into Senate Bill 425. Any discussion? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will support the bill, the amendment, and the bill today with the reservation. I really needed to discuss the aids and facilitates a little more and how broad that language actually is.
Okay.
It seems to open a really large venue.
All right. Other questions, comments?
Mr. Chair and Council, are these consensus amendments or no? Do we have different objections or does everybody pretty much agreed on the amendments? Do you know, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, these amendments are evolved through the system. I can't say whether they're consensus amendments or not.
I bet they were a work group.
I would imagine that the defense bar would sure like to have 15, 16, and 17-year-olds outside of the 70-month sentence. I would imagine the district attorneys would not. I imagine the Dash 4 is somewhere in the middle situation. We do have an expansion through aids and facilitates. I think that when we were talking in the work group, we were talking about conduct. For example, the cab driver that knows that he's driving the young lady to some kind of activity like this, probably...
All right, let me do this. We're getting more details here. Does the committee want some time to look at these before we go any further? All right, let's do that. All right, what I'm going to do is ask you to withdraw your...
We could adopt the force and then...
And adopt them later.
The original bill isn't going to go. It's got to have an amendment there.
Right.
And so the fours are. Let's go ahead and finish adopting the fours and we've got that.
Other comments on the Dash 4s? All those in. Anyone in objection to the Dash 4s being amended into 425? Not seen, so ordered. And you want to go ahead and move it? Or do you want to wait time?
Let's.
Time?
We can roll it.
Yeah, we're going to do that tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's roll it till tomorrow.
All right. And then on.
But you need to say that.
Yeah, I'm going to.
Okay.
I'm just looking at what I'm going before that. All right. So at this point, what we're going to do is we're going to take SB 425. We're going to close the work session with the intention of rolling it over till tomorrow, which will be Thursday. So I'll close the work session on the 425, open the work session on 426.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 426 creates a grant program for the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to assist law enforcement agencies in the investigation and prosecution of those who compel others into prostitution or engage in human trafficking, directs the Department of Human Services to develop a treatment program for minors who are victims of sex trafficking. Chair, members of the committee, you have the Dash 2 amendments, which basically add the language as a sex crime on page 1 and page 2, as opposed to just a clarifying amendment. As chair, members of the committee, this has a prior referral to Ways and Means Committee.
All right. Chair, will take a motion on the Dash 2s.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to 426, Senate Bill 426.
All right. Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2s into Senate Bill 426. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 426 as amended by the Dash 2s to the floor with a D-pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 426 as amended by the Dash 2s with a D-pass recommendation to the floor with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. All right, and now we're going to close that work session on 426, open up a work session on 430.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 430 was heard on February 9th. The bill makes crimes of involuntary servitude, trafficking in persons, and compelling prostitution subject to civil forfeiture. There is a Dash 1 amendment from Representative Olson, which just includes CASA as one of the agencies to which local governments could distribute civil forfeiture funds, and there is no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact on the dash ones.
All right, Chair, we'll take a motion on the dash ones.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 430.
Senator Cruz moves the dash ones into Senate Bill 430. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 430 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 430 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And I will carry the bill. The chair will carry 430. We'll close the work session on 430. Open up our last work session for the day, Senate Bill 654. And counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 654 comes from Senator Shields. Requires that the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to prepare racial and ethnic impact statements describing racial impact for proposed legislation. You have the dash three amendments in front of you, which basically narrow the bill to the issue of where there is an initiative or referral by the legislature to the voters, or there's initiative put together through the signature process. So it requires the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to prepare a racial and ethnic impact statement for initiative measures that affect the racial and ethnic composition of the criminal justice offender population, defines criminal offender population as those convicted of a felony as opposed to the broader crime, defines recipient human resource services as a person found under the jurisdiction of juvenile courts for a dependency matter who receives child welfare services, requires the Secretary of State to have a hearing no later than 95 days before an election to receive suggested changes. The ethnic impact statement applies to elections held after 2012 elections.
All right. Chair will take a motion on the dash three amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendment, Senate Bill 654.
Senator Cruz moves the dash threes into Senate Bill 654. Any discussion?
Just a question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Romney.
The dash three, we're not doing anything with the ones or the twos?
That's correct. The threes are the final version.
And is there a fiscal on this?
Chair members,
that's going to be going to committee. There are two potential fiscals, one to the Criminal Justice Commission and one to the Secretary of State. And I talked to the sponsor of the bill and said that's where it was going to need to go.
Yes.
All right. So any objection to the motion of the dash threes being adopted in the Senate Bill 654? Not seeing any. So ordered. And at this point, the chair will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 654 as amended by
the dash
three amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
All right. Senator Cruz moves the Senate Bill 654 as amended by the dash threes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, but requests that the President refer the matter, the bill to Ways and Means based on the potential fiscal impact to the two, the Commission, the Oregon Justice Commission, as well as the Secretary of State's office based on their duties under the bill. Any discussion? Senator Wissett.
I won't be supporting the bill today. Women are included in this as a minority, and there are actually more women in Oregon than there are men.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I will also be opposing the bill.
All right. Thank you. So any other objections to the motion besides Senator Cruz and Senator Wissett? Not seeing or hearing any. The motion passes. Please acknowledge that Senator Wissett and Senator Cruz opposed the motion at this time. With that, that's going to conclude our work for today. Tomorrow, Thursday, we do need to start at 8 a.m., and we are, in fact, rolling over again Senate Bill 425 until tomorrow for future, for a further work session. With that, we're adjourned.